Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Need a cold coffee with a bold flavor? Dunkin' Cold K-Cup pods were specially crafted for cold coffee. Brew over ice straight out of the Keurig coffee maker for smooth, delicious Dunkin' taste you know and love. Find your next Dunkin' Cold coffee in the roasted coffee aisle.
We're used to hearing advice from older and wiser people about the unexpected twists and turns their lives have taken. But what if the unexpected turn comes in your early 20s and you get derailed by a rare and frightening illness? The chances are 1 in 3 that you'll ever recover. How would you handle that? Well, today's guest is Emmy Award-winning writer Suleika Jawad. Not only did she survive cancer and beat those devastating odds, she shared her journey with millions in a popular New York Times column called Life Interrupted. She's since gone on a 15,000-mile journey to meet others who have also faced incredible obstacles. We'll talk about what she learned along the way. We're also joined by her partner, whose name and music may ring a bell for a lot of you, John Batiste. He's the music director of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and he's recently won the Academy Award for Best Original Score for his work on the beautiful Pixar hit Soul. And the two of them together, well, not only are they one of the coolest couples around, but their empathy for each other is really incredible. I hope their story inspires you as much as it inspires me. I'm Hoda Kotb, and welcome to my podcast, Making Space. First of all, Suleika, I'm crazy about your name. I've been saying it. I've been walking around saying, Suleika, Suleika. What does that mean?
Oh, well, you may know this. It's Zuleika in Arabic, which means the heart robber.
And the heart robber. What were you like as a kid when you found out what your name actually meant?
I think my dad modified it. He told me it meant desert princess, which I'll take as well.
Yeah, you'll take that too. Yeah. When you were little, I love your dad's Tunisian, your mom's Swiss, and you're kind of a mixed bag of all of that rolled into one beautiful package. But when you were a little girl, what did you, like, what was your dream, your dream as a kid?
You know, I call kids who grew up as first-generation Americans or with immigrant parents the spackle, because you do end up having to become a sort of translator between the world and the language and the food that you consume at home and everything that's happening outside of the home. But I, from the time I was very little, was one of those kids who was brimming with creativity. I danced, I played the upright bass, but more than anything, I really loved writing.
Describe, close your eyes for a second, and imagine your childhood bedroom. What's on the walls? What kind of sheets you had? Did you share? Tell me what you see.
So, my parents were strict in certain ways, but when it came to creativity, we had no rules. So I painted my own bedroom very poorly, but I painted it myself. I had lots and lots of books.
Did you have any posters on the wall?
I had a poster of an old Tunisian singer named Ali Riahi.
Is that right? Did you like Ali Riahi?
At Ali Riahi, I had Backstreet Boys posters and Spice Girls posters. That was my jam.
Let me tell you, if anything describes the immigrant experience,
it is
your wall when you were a little kid. That is so cool. So were you super smart in school?
English was my second language. I, on the first day of school, didn't speak a word of English.
Wow.
So school was an interesting experience for me and a challenging experience, especially because my family moved around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until high school that I realized not only that I was smart, but that the smart path would be for me to focus on my studies. And so I had a kind of pretty significant shift in the ninth grade.
So you wound up at Princeton. And did you, I know you were looking at the path of a war correspondent. Why that path?
So right around the time that I graduated, a revolution broke out in Tunisia, which is where my dad's from and where a lot of my family still lives. That was later called the Arab Spring.
Mm-hmm.
And up until that point, I'd been writing and I saw for the first time a path toward a vocation that made sense to me.
Yeah.
I spoke Arabic, I spoke French, and I applied for a job as a stringer in Tunisia for the International Herald Tribune. But before I was able to pursue that, my life changed very dramatically.
So you're going about your business and you get a feeling of a little itchiness, which I think your average Joe would think, oh, well, I don't know what that is, eczema, give me some cream. Mm-hmm. But that was not the case at all. What happened?
So at the time, I was living in Paris. I was just a couple months out of college. And I was working as a paralegal and pursuing this other, you know, stringer position on the side. And I hadn't been feeling well for a while. It started with an itch, and the itch blossomed into all kinds of mysterious symptoms. I was getting colds all the time and coming down with bouts of bronchitis. But the biggest symptom I had was fatigue. Mm. But of course, at 22, everyone is tired.
Yeah.
Everyone that I was hanging out with was working hard and going out at night dancing. And so I didn't really make much of it. And I went to see a number of doctors, all of whom, you know, treated that specific symptom or ailment and sent me home. And toward the end of my time in Paris, I started to get the feeling that my doctors that I was seeing weren't taking me seriously. Mm-hmm. But I think the truth is I wasn't entirely taking myself seriously. Mm-hmm. Youth and health are supposed to go hand in hand.
Sure.
And it was only when I got to a point where I was so weak, it was a struggle to walk up and down the stairs, that I found myself in an emergency room. And within 24 hours, I was on a plane back home to upstate New York. And I got the bone marrow biopsy that led to my actual diagnosis.
To hear the words that you were diagnosed with a specific type of leukemia at 22 is scary enough, but when they said the chances of survival were 1 in 3, I mean, my God, like what goes through a 22-year-old's head?
I think there was this immediate sense of fracture. There was my life before.
Yeah.
And everything that came after. And, you know, I never returned to Paris, to my apartment, to my job. Friends packed up my things and sent them to my house. And I had this sense, even though I couldn't quite wrap my head around what it meant to have a cancer diagnosis at 22, that the person I'd been before was buried. There was no returning to that pre-diagnosis self.
The cancer fight, and I don't know how you describe it, but it usually there's a beginning and an end point for it.
Mm.
I mean, I had breast cancer. I think for 6 or 8 months, I went through stuff.
Yeah.
Your timing, the 3.5, 4 years of going through chemo and bone marrow and chemo again, and this is like, how did you see light? And how did you survive all those days?
So initially I thought, and maybe more so I hoped, that it was just going to be a short trip in the kingdom of the sick. And I was intent on not getting too comfortable, on not letting it kind of take over my identity. And within that, the end of that first summer in the hospital, I learned that none of the standard chemotherapy treatments were working for me. And what, you know, I'd hoped would be a short sojourn was very clearly going to become something much longer. And I think one of the most challenging parts of that experience was the sense of the goalposts moving.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know, you know, on day one that I was going to be in treatment for 3.5 years. And they say you can survive anything as long as you can see the end date in sight. And there came a point in my treatment where I couldn't see that end in sight. And that was the most challenging, I think, to know how to kind of anchor yourself when you're swimming in a sea of uncertainty.
I mean, there are life lessons that come in your worst times. I mean, some change we choose in our life and some is cast upon us, and you have to figure it out. And I remember so clearly how the world got clear. Like, I was never clear. I think I was kind of always mushy about things. Mm-hmm. Those are my friends. I don't love that one so much, but so what? They're nice. I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. And then all of a sudden, you realize, like, my life has a beginning and an end, and I'm not wasting time. Like, that time is over.
Yeah.
Did you have that sensation?
Yeah. I think, like, you know, a lot of people in their early 20s, I had this feeling of time.
Yes.
I had time to figure out who I was, time to figure out what I wanted to do. And that diagnosis brought into immediate, urgent focus the fact that we're all here for a finite mm-hmm. period of time. And I felt a strange sense of urgency around time. Mm-hmm. And I had the same experience. It felt like all the artifice just kind of fell away.
Yeah.
I got clear not only about who my friends were, but maybe more importantly, who I wanted to be friends with and what mm-hmm. kind of relationships I wanted to cultivate. And I had such limited energy that I was well enough to maybe do three things every day, small things, like write an email, watch a movie, see a friend. And what that meant for me was that I had to get very clear about my priorities.
Wow.
And it's something I still think about now, just as a kind of thought exercise. And mm-hmm. I ask myself, you know, if I have three things I can do today, what feels mm-hmm. most important, most meaningful? And I think that's one of the silver linings, and I don't use that word lightly, because obviously there's so much about illness that mm-hmm. does not feel like a silver lining. But that reshuffling of priorities and the kind of clarifying power mm. of having your mortality hang in the balance.
That is so true. And there's something so strange about how free you feel suddenly. You didn't even realize you were carrying all that heavy junk around.
Yeah.
It's like, I didn't even, you know, you don't even realize it. It's like my shoulders feel lighter, even though you're in the middle of it. So to have a doctor say to you after a bone marrow transplant and chemo again, I don't know if you used the term cancer-free or mm-hmm. you are in remission, but to hear those words, what did that moment feel like?
Mm. I mean, I had been hoping to hear those words for almost 3.5 years. The goal had always been to survive. And I'd spent, you know, 1,400 days working tirelessly Jeez. Toward that goal. And I thought when I got to that place, I would want to celebrate.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel anything like what I'd imagined. I was physically, you know, wrecked from going through those treatments. I was grieving my loss of identity, my sense of self. I was grieving my fellow, you know, cancer buddies that I'd made. My best friend, Melissa, had died earlier that month, and I was grieving a relationship that hadn't survived the stresses of illness. And so I felt this weird dissonance between what should be and what was.
Yeah.
I wanted to feel grateful. I wanted to quickly and organically fold back into the rhythms of living. But instead, I found myself in this kind of limbo, this kind of in-between place where on paper, I was better. Mm-hmm. But off paper, I couldn't have felt further from being the healthy, happy, you know, 27-year-old that I'd hoped to be on the other side of all this.
Especially because when you spend almost, 3.5 years in one space, it's the same thing. The idea that, okay, now this is over and all your friends or some of your friends and colleagues are saying, oh, great. So now we can go back to the way it was. Let's go out to the bar. Let's go have some fun.
Exactly.
You weren't feeling those things.
Yeah, I wanted to be
you
feeling
wanted to,
those
yeah.
things. But, you know, I think often when we talk about things like cancer, the kind of final act yeah. or the end of the story comes with a cure, but we mm-hmm. don't talk a lot about what happens after. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to even acknowledge to myself how much I was struggling. There were so many unanswered questions that I didn't know what to do with. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, how do I find a job when I need to nap for 4 hours mm-hmm. in the day, or my immune system is still sending me to the emergency room on a regular basis? How do I date when I have a quarter inch of hair and a port still in my chest? How do I talk about, you know, the side effects of chemo, like infertility or early menopause? Like, all of it felt so overwhelming. And in a weird way, I found myself almost wishing that I was still sick, not because I wanted to have leukemia, of course, but I understood the hospital ecosystem.
Right.
That was the world I lived in for 4 years. I felt comfortable there. I looked like the other patients. It was the outside world that felt scary and foreign and daunting to me.
When we come back, Suleika on life after a deadly diagnosis and how feeling lost inspired her to take a trip of a lifetime. And her partner, musician John Batiste, joins the conversation.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
So I love your New York Times column. I thought it was so beautiful and riveting and moving. But what I loved so much more was when people reached out to you because they wanted, because they connected with you. You had this way that whether you were sick before or you weren't, or you knew, somehow people felt you, like that you reached across and you grabbed them by the heart. And people wrote you letters. And you know, in this industry, sometimes you get a letter and you got beautiful letters and you read them, but then you did something totally amazing. Like I have not heard of someone doing this, but what did you do with those letters that you got?
So, you know, in that year after I finished treatment, I was in the most lost place I've ever been. I knew I wasn't a cancer patient anymore. I knew I couldn't return to the person I'd been pre-diagnosis, but I had no idea who I was. And so I started thinking about these different rites of passages that we have in our culture, these kind of ritualized ceremonies that help us move through transitions like baby showers and weddings and funerals. And I realized that there wasn't a kind of ritual or rite of passage when you emerge from a long illness. And I needed that. I needed time to reckon with what I'd been through and to reflect on who I wanted to become. I needed the space away from my home and my kind of cancer identity to really kind of come into my own. And so I hatched this kind of boondoggle of a plan, and I decided to learn how to drive.
You didn't have your license.
I did not have my license. I rented out my apartment and I borrowed a friend's car, and I ended up embarking on a 15,000-mile road trip across the country to meet some of the strangers who'd written me letters about their own major life interruptions and their own stories of transition. And they really, you know, those individuals, there were about 22 of them that I visited, became my sort of breadcrumb trail through the wilderness of survivorship.
By the way, I was just imagining, like, pretend I wrote you a letter, and all of a sudden I'm sitting out doing yard work, edging my lawn, and you roll up in your car with your dog. Hey, and I'd be like totally freaked out. So what was it like when you actually went up and met these people? They probably, I mean, they didn't even know if you got the letter. Letters are like you send it off and it goes into a black hole, but yet there you stood on their driveway.
It was extraordinary. I mean, I, you know, after being sick for so long, my relationship to fear changed dramatically. Yeah. I was always prepared for the other shoe to drop, prepared for something to go wrong. And what I found instead in these encounters and on that road trip was that the world really welcomed me at every turn. I ended up, you know, staying on someone's fold-out couch. You know, I stayed with on a ranch in Wyoming with a family of survivalist ranchers. I visited a high school teacher in California who was grieving the death of her son. I went to a maximum security prison in Texas to visit a death row convict. And each of those conversations helped me gain a sense of perspective on my own predicament. But more than that, I think it showed me a way to reimagine community. And it gave me this sense of connection that at a time in my life when I felt so lost and so isolated, really helped me see a path forward.
So you, because sometimes when you are going through a difficult time and you meet someone who is also going through a difficult time, sometimes it's helpful and sometimes it's a little burdensome. You're like, I don't know how much I can take of this pain. I feel like I'm carrying mine. But it didn't seem like it worked that way for you.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, my experience has been that when we dare to share our most vulnerable moments and stories, there's a kind of reverberation that happens and a call and response. And vulnerability begets vulnerability begets vulnerability. And to be able to kind of tell and talk about the unvarnished truth of what it means to have your life upended, whether by, you know, a cancer diagnosis or some other kind of heartbreak or loss that brings you to the floor, and to be able to talk about that with people who had experienced some version of that felt like such a gift. Yeah, I call them my road guardians, those people.
And I looked up all your stuff. You're just amazing. You're amazing. No, really. You do, like, the most amazing stuff. Your vlogs are amazing. And then it's funny how this is happening, and now you're here. You're here. It's crazy.
And where are we?
We're in Sebring. Little Florida. Little Sebring, Florida.
The little girl, Unique, was that her name? Another girl who you saw? What was her issue? Do you remember?
So Unique was, I believe, about 13 years old when she first wrote to me. And she had been diagnosed with cancer.
Oh, okay.
And because her family lived far away from her treatment center, was in a hospital room alone for many, many months. And when I went on my road trip, she was just finishing treatment. And so I knew immediately that I was going to drive to Florida and go see her. And I'll never, you know, forget picking her up that day for lunch. I knocked on the door and I just heard screams on the other side. And this tiny little adorable pint-sized girl just busted out the door full of energy and full of excitement. And I remember asking her, like, you're about to rejoin the greater gathering. What do you want to do now that you've been given this clean bill of health? And she was, I think, 16, 17 at the time. And she said, I want to go camping and I want to come visit you in New York and I want to try weird foods like octopus that I've never tasted before, and on and on and on. And, you know, what struck me so much about her and her joy and her excitement is that sometimes when you've been through a big trauma, especially a life-threatening diagnosis, is that daydreaming about the future can feel like a scary exercise because you don't know if you're going to exist there. But I think what she embodies so beautifully is that kind of daydreaming and hope can feel dangerous, but it's so much more daring and such a richer, more beautiful way to live your life.
Oh my God, I'm getting chills thinking about that. Oh my word. Are you happy?
I'm so happy.
what makes you happy now?
The strange thing in the last year of this pandemic is I found myself living a version of the life that I had when I was sick, which is to say that my circle is much smaller.
Right.
My life is quieter. And I don't know about you, but I have spent so much of the last decade striving and working and hustling. And I feel so privileged to get to do work that I love. Mm-hmm. But I've also been thinking about the way that working at that pace can be its own kind mm-hmm. of trauma response. Mm-hmm. So this year for me, my goal has been leisure, which isn't to say I'm not working all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, these small moments that I've gotten to have in the last year of being at home with our dogs, of gardening, of hanging out with my partner, John.
You know, it's so interesting because I sometimes think like life is full of exclamation points. It's like the good ones. You graduated from college, you meet a great guy, you have a baby, you get married. And then on the flip side, it's you get a sad diagnosis, somebody passes away, et cetera. But most of the days are just Wednesday in the middle. Nothing terrific and nothing horrible, just Wednesday.
Something I've been thinking about recently is trying to approach my Wednesday as ritual, washing the dishes as ritual, gardening as ritual, and really trying to kind of slow down and savor that because it's so easy to move from one exclamation point to the next. But I'm sure, as you know, when you get a scary diagnosis, you're not thinking about the things that are on your resume. You're thinking about the people you love and wanting to spend time with them. You're thinking about the things that nourish you. And yeah, all the rest doesn't matter as much and it falls away. You know, we live in a country that has this culture or this anxiety of around accomplishment. And in this season in my life, I'm trying very hard to resist that and to kind of center myself back in those things that I love, the same things that I loved as a little girl, the dancing and music and writing and family.
Speaking of music, so you play the stand-up bass? Is that—
I play the stand-up bass.
Girl, you rock, man. That is so cool. You always loved that when you were younger?
You know, I started on piano when I was five and I hated it. And my mom was very strict and made me practice every day. And when I was eight, I got the option of picking a second instrument. And I picked the instrument that I thought would inconvenience my parents the most.
You were so bad.
I know. I was so bad. And that was the bass. And I immediately fell in love with it. It's, you know, it's one of the only instruments that's so big that you have to actually hug it to play it.
Yeah.
And you feel every note in your chest. And I immediately fell in love with it.
And music has always been a big part of your life?
Music has always been a big part of my life.
Which explains your very handsome and awesome boyfriend. If you don't know John Batiste, and we're going to bring him in here in just a second, but he's a cool cat. Boy, is he something special.
He is.
I mean, and you met him when you were 13 at band camp.
I did.
I mean, that's like, talk about a full circle life right here.
Yeah, back when we were in braces and ill-fitting clothes and supremely awkward. We'll fact check this with John.
When we come right back, Suleika's partner joins us. Did we mention he's also pretty big time? Academy Award-winning musician John Batiste of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hey, it's Mel Robbins, and I've got a new podcast. Here's why you're gonna love listening to it. It's about life and the simple things you can do to create a better one. I'll be sharing my funny stories and proven tools that have helped millions of people change their lives. Every episode will move you emotionally, move you to think differently, or move you into action. Listen to the Mel Robbins podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I'm sitting smack dab in the middle of a love story. Okay, so you're 13 years old. You're both geeks. I know you are at 13 because nobody was not a geek at 13.
Oh, yeah, fully. So
are you guys close to the same age?
Yeah, we're about a year and a half apart.
A year and a half apart. Mm-hmm. So, John, do you remember your girl from band camp at age 13?
So here's what I remember.
Uh-huh.
I remember Birkenstocks. This is not an endorsement.
You had Birkenstocks on?
Before they were cool.
Yeah.
She was ahead. Zuleika was ahead.
Now, and I also must say, I am honored to talk to you because when I was growing up at that time, I was watching you on WWL.
Come on. Come on.
So when I was growing up in New Orleans, Kendall, Louisiana, You'd be on TV. My first time leaving was to go to this band camp. First time leaving home and being somewhere for the summer. You go somewhere for the summer for the first time. It's like a new world.
Yeah. Where was band camp? Where were you?
Saratoga Springs.
Oh, so you took a big trip. This was not a nothing. All right.
Upstate New York.
So you were already, what instrument were you playing, John, at the time?
Piano. And I saw her in the courtyard. And this is, you know, again, I thought this was maybe a New York thing. People wear Birkenstocks. Nobody was wearing that in New Orleans.
No, they weren't. Those were not cool in New Orleans.
And I thought what immediately came to my mind was, oh, she's like a hippie. You know, like granola. Like that vibe.
Crunchy granola. And how did you, at 13, did you have any confidence level at 13? Or were you like a lot of 13-year-old girls? You did? She did.
Definitely.
I was a 13-year-old going on 20. I thought I was far more mature than I actually was.
That's impressive. Most 13-year-old girls feel so incredibly awkward.
I was just coming out of what I call UDS, ugly duckling syndrome. I'd just gotten contacts for the first time to replace my eyeballs, glasses.
Okay. So now at 13, that's when the crushes start happening. Was there a crush or were you all just friends?
No. No? No crush.
Yeah.
I was very much a late bloomer.
Uh-huh.
So I was into music and video games and martial arts and chess, things like
eclectic.
That.
Eclectic. You got a nice array.
All the nerdy activities.
Yeah. I was about to say all the introspective kind of introvert activities.
Yeah. So
you see.
So like when you saw him, did you just thought a nice kid? Nice guy.
I remember thinking he was a little strange because I think I tried to initiate a conversation and conversation was not happening.
You were not into it? You just weren't a conversationalist then?
I think there's a glorious awkwardness in coming into your own at that age.
Yeah,
and I think it's strange, but a beautiful strange. And I feel like I've kept that until adulthood. But, you know, I still, you know, I feel like we probably tried to speak. And at that time, anybody who I talked to.
Yeah.
And she's always been a great communicator, always magnetic, able to communicate the emotions that other people are feeling. I noticed that about her immediately.
Yeah.
But there was no crush. We linked later in college. And that's when we started to really become more friends.
Okay. So did y'all went to school together, Zuleika?
John was a freshman at Juilliard and I was in the pre-college program. But what I will say about John,
don't bury the lead.
What's the lead?
She's so talented.
There you go.
You got to understand, she was at Juilliard pre-college playing the double bass. Now, musicians know the double bass is not a joke.
Yeah.
That instrument is, were playing the double bass back at the camp. And this instrument was bigger than her.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're playing the double bass with the bow, the intonation to get it in tune and to command that instrument is really tremendous.
So you're at Juilliard. You're in the pre-college. He's at Juilliard. So you got two musical geniuses going on. And so we didn't have no little spark, no chemistry.
You know what's weird? Mm-hmm. My first week at Juilliard, I was on the one train with my friend Michelle, and I had I hadn't thought about John since band camp several years earlier, which when you're a teenager feels like a decade. And I see this young man on the train who is singing to himself and playing the air piano. And people were kind of staring because even in New York, that's not a sight that you see every day. And I looked at him and I turned to my friend and I said, "That's John Batiste. What is he doing here?" And I said, "That's the man I'm going to marry someday."
And I just blurted it out and forgot about it. I want to stop for a second. On the one train, you knew you were going to marry John?
It was like one of those things you just say, and I didn't think about it, and I didn't give it much weight.
So is that the last you see of her before you know she's not feeling well?
No. Mm-hmm. We saw each other. This is in college, my first year, her last year of high school. Then she doesn't end up going to Juilliard.
Right.
She goes to Princeton. Then
at
Princeton, she has this incredible time. We don't see each other. In passing, we see each other at performances here and there.
Right.
We have mutual friends, but we're not really as connected.
Yeah.
Then she has a going away party because she's moving. You move into Paris. And I went to the going away party with a mutual friend of ours.
Mm-hmm.
And Michelle Ross took me to the party. And we're friends at this point, but not really close friends in that way. But then that was when there was a spark at that party, the going away party. But she was going away.
Going to Paris.
So
bye.
That it was not, you know, the timing.
You were pining, John. A little. You're pining
a little. We had a moment.
Uh-huh.
We had a moment.
Well, you got to have a moment. I mean, come on. Going to Paris, y'all. There's love in the air.
Yes.
Okay. So let's fast forward to how did you learn that Suleika was ill, was not well?
So that same friend, Michelle, told me one day. We were playing, you know, my band. We would play in public places often, you know, not for money, just to bring the music, revelry, joy. We were playing in the subway one day, and she told me, and I gathered the rest of my band, because at this time it was just a few of us. Mm-hmm. I gathered the rest of them, and we went to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And you know, I hadn't heard that she was that ill until that moment.
Mm-hmm.
It was a real moment of clarity that I had to do something, and what I do is music. I just felt I needed to bring that to the situation to help in any way that I could. So that's what I did.
But that must have been emotional because you didn't expect to see her in that way.
I guess there's an impact that a person has on you that you don't know the full extent of until you're in a moment of crisis. So it felt like I needed to do something in that moment, even though we weren't super close friends. It felt like, oh, I really connect with this person. I respect this person, what she's all about, what I know of her. This is important. So that's why we went to the hospital and we played, and it was a beautiful experience.
I'd love for everybody to hear a little bit of that. Did you feel like you were doing some good?
Yes, I felt like we were doing good, but that was a special thing for our relationship, a special time to, you know, you see each other through these different phases and you see what a person is like when they're 13, 14. Then you see what a person is like at the beginning of college. Then you see what a person is like when they finish college and going out into the world. Then you see what a person is like when they're going through tremendous duress. The impact of that on their life, meeting the family, understanding, you know, how that impacts a whole community.
Yeah.
It was important.
So, like, what was it like to watch him light up the room?
What John didn't know was that the day before, I'd learned that the chemotherapy I'd been doing wasn't working. Mm-hmm. I'd entered the hospital with 30% leukemic blasts. And by the end of this really harrowing treatment, I had 70%.
Oh, jeez.
And so at that point, my only option was an experimental clinical trial. Mm. And my family, I mean, I remember not even being able to look my parents in the eyes because I knew that if I saw how devastated they looked, I just wouldn't be able to hold it together. Mm. And John showed up in the middle of that with his entire band. And put on this impromptu concert. And the extraordinary thing about music is that, especially maybe when you're in a low down place, it has this kind of musical antidepressant effect. And it wasn't just for me and my family. It was the whole cancer ward.
Wow.
And patients and nurses and doctors started to trickle out into the hallways and people began to dance and sing and clap their hands.
It's true.
But it's also a testament to John, because John is someone who shows up in the difficult moments and who keeps on showing up, not just for me, but for everybody. Mm. And he's always been that way.
Well, you got to show them. You got to show people you love them.
Mm-hmm.
I urge everybody out there, you show the person in your life who you haven't told or you haven't shown your love, show them.
How do you show Suleika that you love her?
I find that every day is a new, it's not a challenge necessarily, but it's a call. You know, there's a call to, maybe it's doing a dish, or maybe it's going to the hospital. Maybe, you know, it's thinking of something that she would want or needs that she's not thinking of, because we're so creative people are so tied up into their ideas that you need someone to think of the basics for you sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
That's a way of showing love.
That's a good point. You get caught up and you're like, hey, have you had a meal today? Did you miss X? Yeah, you fill in that blank.
You should have been at our house last week when I wake up at 4 a.m. to fire alarms everywhere because John was cooking and had decided to learn how to make fried chicken. But that's been his way of, I think, one of your new love languages in the last year has been through food. You're always making sure that there's dinner, that there's something that nourishes the two of us, or bringing me.
In a house, you gotta have smells, aromas.
How about
and fire alarms.
Any crawfish boil yet or not yet?
Ooh.
Come on now, John. Get the crawfish boil going. Don't even think that you have not done that yet.
Come on now.
Come on. When y'all go to New Orleans, I'm going with you, okay?
Yeah,
I want to go. I want to go. I'll show you how to do the crawfish.
Yes.
I got those down. So what's the future with you two?
Well, it's a beautiful thing to have family. We look forward to something in that realm. You know, there's complications.
Yeah.
You know, I don't feel like that is ever a barrier to family, because you can
plenty
figure
of ways
out.
To make a family, right?
Yeah, I think it's possible. It's all about love.
Well, and I'll just say, like, I think one of my big anxieties coming out of this illness was finding a partner who understood that and who wasn't sort of scared of having hard conversations or awkward conversations around things. And I remember talking to John about infertility early on as a result of my treatment. And he said, there are many ways to make a family, and it's its own kind of creative act. And you've just been understanding and open in a way that I wish were the norm, but that I feel very grateful for.
She's a very real person. Eloquent, but she can say she's real. So it's easy to have real, authentic conversations.
Well, I know that she's taught you a lot. Is there anything What do you think is the most significant thing Suleika's taught you?
Wow. So I think it's something in the realm of friendship, how to stay connected with people through long, long periods of time, through lots of changes. She has the most friends from years ago.
Because that you can tell a person, by the way, by their friendships, how long people have been in their lives. Absolutely. So she's taught you that.
That aren't family.
No. Just friends. Yeah. That tells you a lot about somebody.
Huge lesson for me. As someone I travel and I meet people all over the world, and I'm always somewhere, and there's a lot of people in my life, but connecting with those people and really building that community. You know, we've been building a community of our own, too. So that's one of the biggest lessons that I'm still learning from her.
Tell me what John's taught you. I want to know. And John wants to know, too.
You know, I think John is one of the most creatively brilliant people I know. But what I've loved observing and learning from is the way creativity informs every aspect of his life, including our relationship. Mm. And so one example of that is we both travel a lot for work in non-pandemic times. And because of that, have to spend sometimes several weeks apart. And he came up with this idea early on in our relationship, which was to write each other a letter every day by hand. Instead of doing like your morning pages or writing in a journal, he would write a letter by hand, take a photo of it, and text it to me. And it brought me back to those letters that I got on the road trip.
Wow.
And I think that there's sometimes certain things that you can only say in the written word that you don't even maybe know you need to say that come out when you're writing letters. But you're always doing stuff like that. You're always finding creative ways for us to deepen our relationship and to stay connected.
By the way, that is the most beautiful and thoughtful and smart. I was thinking, write a letter, but how are you ever going to get it? You take a picture and text it so you can actually read the handwriting. Brilliant.
Right?
Joel and I are stealing that. Thank you. I have to tell you, watching your story from the beginning unfold, and I've been reading and watching a lot leading up to this interview, and sitting here in this moment and looking at you two is so beautiful.
Thank you.
Love is in the air, baby.
Oh.
Yes.
All right, Suleika, John, thank you guys so much. We appreciate you being on Making Space. Hey guys, thanks so much for listening and going on this journey with me. If you like what you've heard, and I sure hope you do, please give Making Space a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. And be sure to tell your friends and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Making Space with Hoda Kotb is produced by Allison Berger and Ursula Summer, along with associate producer Olivia Ruchard and audio engineer Bob Mallory. Original music by John Estes. Bryson Barnes is our technical director. Minika Thoria is our executive producer. Soraya Gage is our general manager. And Madeline Herringer is our head of editorial.
If you ever needed to be persuaded that bad things can happen anywhere, then take a journey with us.
From compelling mysteries to in-depth investigations, our Dateline episodes are available as podcasts.
Follow Dateline NBC now to get new episodes every Tuesday. To listen ad-free, subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com.
Great storytelling with a twist from the true crime original.